Hello and welcome to another episode of Radio Warnerd. The date today is January 30th, 2023, and this is episode 364, and you're listening to Radio Warnerd, which you can find at Patreon, where you can subscribe for the newsletters at all. Patreon.com/Radio Warnerd. Anyway, I'm the co-host, Mark Ames, here in Rochester, Western New York, and I am on the line with John D, a.k.a. Gary Brecher, a.k.a. the Warnerd, in Carthage, or just outside Carthage.
A ways from Carthage, a town called Hammamet, which is right on the coast south of Carthage. But we did visit Carthage in an official Radio Warnerd field trip by taxi. And I just want to give people.
Did you fly the Radio Warnerd flag on your way there, you know, so that people knew?
in spirit, but the taxi driver wouldn't have gone for any literal flagging. But it was a pretty remarkable trip. I mean, for one thing, Tunisia is a really pleasant surprise. I didn't know it got cold in North Africa. Call me dumb, but it gets darn cold here.
Yeah, I looked it up. You guys are in like the 40s and 50s. I mean, it's like winter in Northern California kind of thing, right?
Yeah, and one of the reasons we came here is because there's a pool and I need to reawaken some muscles in my what used to be my left arm because it sort of got atrophied after I smashed the bones in it.
Right.
So we have forced ourselves to swim. Catherine's gone in with me, to the astonishment of the hotel staff. Mm. And it's really working. You know, it's been great. And it's true what they say. After the first minute or so, you don't mind it so much. It doesn't feel so cold.
Right.
That first minute is quite remarkable, though.
Yeah.
But anyway, we visited Carthage. And all I can say, and Mark, you'll know about why I'm saying this, read Salambo.
Yes. Yeah.
Flaubert got it right. I don't know how, and I don't think it's a kind of show your work thing. He just got it right intuitively in the way that Plato said poets do. It's a remarkable sight and kind of sad in a way. And yet, thanks to Salambo, I didn't start feeling sorry for the Carthaginians because they're pretty horrible.
Yeah.
And,
yeah, they give the Romans a run for their money and horribleness, don't they? I know.
Yeah, it's sort of bad versus bad and maybe versus worse. But it is one of the most beautiful sites I've ever seen. We were on the hill of Bursa, where some of the main temples were. And, you know, the typical of an ancient city, the temple hill, like the Acropolis, was also a last-ditch keep or fortress. The Romans had a real vengeance on Carthage. They didn't just destroy it. They destroyed everything they could, including the texts, so that there's not much material. I've been looking for material. And I think, you know, really, Flaubert's guess was as good as anybody's, and in fact, better because he had the sensibility for it. But there is this wondrous feeling that this must have been a miraculous place when the sun was shining on the sea, which surrounds the city in every direction. And it was a strange place. That's one thing you can be sure of, that Carthage and the Punic cities in general, like Tyre in Lebanon, which was the parent city of the Carthaginian colony, they were strange. And they divided up city by city, unlike Rome, which imposed a very strong central authority on everything. The Carthaginians, the other Punic colonies became strange in their own ways, but it's all gone now. It's a lot of the ruins on the top of this hill are actually medieval because Louis the Ninth was involved in launching one of his crusades from there. It did not go well, which led to him becoming St. Louis. but I don't know how much
name of a lot of schools. I don't know if it's the same Louis, but there are a lot of private schools.
That too. There are a lot of St. Louis because the French church got involved with the state in a familiar way. Mm. But all in all, I mean, I don't want to idealize Tunisia too much, but I mean, like last night, we saw some guy on a scooter zoom out of a side street and slam right into the side of a car.
Eesh.
And it was his fault, there's no doubt. Yeah. And it was a weekend night, and maybe he was drinking, I don't know. But what I noticed particularly was this young male response, because like many times when I was young, I'm sure it's happened to you too, that when you're young, what you fear most is embarrassment. Mm-hmm. So at the moment you're in shock, you wake up on the ground, and the first thing you want to do is get up so nobody laughs at you. You know, you got to get up. And I did that once when I was young, and I fainted dead away. Mm. But this guy got up and he was yelling to the car, but you could tell his Vespa was wrecked. He's going to feel it 20 years from now. And it was a reminder that unemployment is running really, really high here, especially since the tourist industry cratered after the beach and museum attacks a few years ago.
Right.
That museum, Borsa Museum, is still closed, in fact.
Wow.
They never really opened it up again. So the country is in really bad shape, but the people are extraordinarily polite, courteous, and reserved in a dignified way. I mean, plus it's cold. How often do you get real cold anymore?
I know, that's cool. Cold, but not snowy. But
no,
like I said, right? More like West Coast.
It's
cold.
A lot more like California.
Yeah, that's great.
Whereas W.C. Fields said you can freeze to death under a rose bush in full bloom.
Right. He was speaking seriously and metaphorically, though.
Yeah, it works both ways.
Yeah. All right, well, let's get to... Anyway, first of all, it sounds like fun, and I'm going to say this again, and I think a couple of people sort of, you know, give an approval to it. We do have to do Punic Wars at some point. I mean, it is pretty amazing. Or even Salambo or you know, some version of that, because that's some pretty amazing stuff. And Hannibal, I mean...
Yeah.
Yeah,
that scene of Hamilcar dedicating the child Hannibal to eternal vengeance on Rome, that always spoke to me. Like, just whatever you do, never mind if it's miserable or failed, just get the Romans.
All right, so... Speaking of Vespas hitting armored vehicles, this is my segue.
Suave segue.
Isn't that? That's why I'm a pro. Yeah. We are excited to have with us today John Griffiths. He is the host of Totally Tanked, the Totally Tanked podcast, which has gotten a lot of play in the Radio War Nerd Facebook page. As you can tell by the title of the podcast, it is a podcast about tanks. And, you know, what war nerd has not gone through or is still going through their tank nerd phase. Anyway, first of all, thank you for joining the show and welcome, John. John G.
Thank you very much, Mark. It's an absolute pleasure to be with you. I've been a subscriber since episode one. So to get on the show is a big thrill.
Wow. Great.
We should mention that John G. woke up at 5 a.m. to be on the show because he's in Canberra, I think.
Canberra, Australia, correct.
Yeah, that's very military of you to get up at 5 a.m. for the show.
Actually set the alarm at 4 to make sure I had time to get a cup of coffee. But here we are. It's all great.
And for once, we're going to give hardware people all the hardware they can handle. We're
gonna
roll right over them.
It's time to count the rivets.
John made a bunch of great notes and... You know, I don't know. I'm kind of thinking of this like let's not assume everybody already knows so much. I mean, I don't know. I'd like to hear the story even briefly. If you can even just give even a 2-minute summary, whatever, a brief history of tanks. I mean, obviously what we're going to get to are the tanks in the Ukraine war. That's, tanks have made a big comeback, you know, in that war. But there's a lot we're kind of not getting or getting wrong. So there's a lot to talk about there. But I just think before we get there, maybe a brief history of tanks, and then we'll sort of do a little brief taxonomy of different armored wheeled vehicles as well. If that's all right with you.
Absolutely. So look, okay. To start, we've got to go back to the chariots.
I made
it kind of joking there, because fundamentally what makes a tank is mobility, protection, and firepower. And you go back to the chariots, and that essentially was providing all of those things, although mobility had some issues, as John Dolan's noted.
I was just doing a dumb guess there.
We, anytime people are in conflict, the need to protect units and have them be able to move on the battlefield and inflict damage, that's always been a combination that's been sought after.
But chariots were great for like early Technicolor movies, let's be honest. I mean, you know, put Chuck Heston in one and you got a flick, you know.
Well, once you've lived in Mesopotamia, it's a totally flat, mud, dried floodplain.
Right.
Sure, and you know, for being able, just to be able to move up and down roads even can be all you actually need, which you know we'll get to with some of the more modern vehicles. But you know, you get to the birth of the tank formally in 1916 at the Battle of the Somme, when they threw them in early. You know, just because the battlefield had become so intense, and you know, artillery barrages with shrapnel, you've got essentially steel rain, and if you can't keep the rain off, you're dead. Mm-hmm. In many ways, the war in Ukraine at the moment is reaching a similar status where nothing can move on the battlefield or survive without being significantly protected, and that's why they're calling for armored vehicles now there. So, you know, the tank, not a particularly auspicious debut in 1916. They mostly all broke down and got destroyed, which is an important point that even from its first day, the tank has not been an insoluble problem to the enemy. It's just a problem that has to be solved. So tanks have always been able to be destroyed, and they can definitely still be destroyed. But that's sort of the birth of it. And then in World War II, obviously, they became incredibly important. And the fall of France got everyone thinking about how to use tanks more and more and more, although the Soviets were very much ahead of the field on that one. It's hard to understate just how significant Russia's been in tank development throughout its history.
That's really interesting. I'm sorry to stop you here for a second, because that's just, just speaking sort of in the war nerd kind of American or maybe Western, I don't know, point of view, everyone was mostly obsessed with, you either were really obsessed with sort of, you know, allied meaning Anglo and American tanks, or the German panzers. And that's all anybody drew on their binders and sort of obsessed about. And the T-34s, the Russian tanks, it was sort of, they just didn't get talked about that much. I mean, certainly not as technologically more advanced. It was more like, it was more like a horde. You know, the idea was, well, they can win in a horde, but you know, those German tanks are so much better. It was always that the Germans were technologically advanced, but you know, you're saying that the Russians have always been pretty advanced in tank technology.
Briefly, let's touch on the T-34, because it is such an important tank and it does feed into modern Russian tank design. In the T-34, you had a 76mm gun in the late 1930s. You had a 550-horsepower aluminium block diesel engine. You know, these are things that the rest of the world wasn't catching up to till the 1943. Mm. Now, the T-34 definitely had a whole bunch of other problems, mostly due to rush production. And also they were using underwater welding, which was something that the West didn't even realize was a thing until years later.
What do you mean with underwater welding?
When you perform a weld on a factory floor, you've always got a problem that you've got hot molten steel and there's oxygen in the atmosphere all getting into it.
Right.
And if you can do your jigs and run your arc weld underwater, then you can get some improvements in your metallurgy. This also comes into development of tanks that people realizing the welded tank hulls were a much better idea than bulging them together with rivets, which the British were doing into 1944 and beyond. So, because to try not to get too bogged down, the problem with riveted armor, and I'm sure you've seen older tanks, particularly from the 1930s, with looks like they've got acne. They've got dots all over them.
Yes, together. Yeah.
Mm. When a rivet, when the tank gets hit by something unpleasant, the rivets all shear and the inside of the tank's filled with pieces of hypersonic rivet. So tank crews do not like riveted tanks at all.
God.
pulling it out of your chest. That's a good rivet.
If you go back to the World War One tanks, they literally had little chainmail veils for the crews to look out the eye slits with, because the incoming machine gun fire, there was literally lead flowing through the eye slits. If you go to a lot of war museums, have them because they're so striking. It looks like cataphracts or something with these chainmail veils.
Right.
Wow.
Yeah, those World War One tanks, I got to say, I mean, I don't want to talk about them too much now, but they're incredible. I mean, you stood up in them, like all these people standing up with these different guns pointing in different directions. They're insane.
Huge crews, 12 people inside, and an exposed engine in the body of the tank. So if anyone loses their feet and puts their hand down, that's a third degree burn straight off the bat. And you know, the fumes, and I mean, the things were terrible, except for marching forward on foot across the plains in northern France, which was worse.
And the T-34 enjoyed some great days. After World War II. Like, I remember as a kid, I mean, one of the few times you really did get an appreciation for Soviet tank technology was when you read about the first American battle of the Korean War, Task Force Smith, as it was called, firing these recoilless rifles at the T-34s. And it was sort of like firing a handgun at the Terminator. It was just like the thing just keeps coming.
Mm. Yeah, you needed a solid weapon to take out a T-34, which, you know, the Germans obviously discovered somewhat to their horror while they were enjoying Barbarossa, that there were these just between the T-34 and then the KV-1 series tanks, which became the IS, Joseph Stalin series later. The KVs were enormously heavily armored, and there were stories of these things being just totally surrounded and firing away for days.
Wow.
So the Germans, certainly folks like Guderian, were writing, even as Barbarossa was happening, that, hang on, we're outflanking the Russians and they're in terrible disarray, so we're making huge progress, but we can't actually destroy these tanks either. This is going to be a problem down the road.
Wow.
When everyone, you know, fetishizes the German heavy and super heavy tanks of late World War II, the Russian IS-2, with a 122-millimeter gun that was immune to, from the front to the German 88s, really should have a lot more fandom. I know that Peter Samsonov at Tank Archives has got a new book out on the IS-2 that I haven't read it myself yet, but knowing him, I would recommend it if you're interested, because that is a tank produced in numbers, and it was engaged in huge battles in the late war where it was wiping out King Tigers and Panthers with great abandon. So, really interesting.
Well, we can check that up to the Cold War. I mean, it's getting quite a score as we go back through 20th century history, and now its malign influence is felt even in the most hardware-ish of military history then.
Very much. The important point to take from the T-34, though, is that this guy, Konstantin Chelpan, in the Ukraine in the 1930s at the Kharkiv train factory, came up with this aluminium block diesel engine that would throw out 550 horsepower. That engine, with some modifications, would keep powering all Russian armor into the start of the T-90 series.
Wow. So that's until recently, basically, because the T-90 is the 1990s, I think, right?
That's correct. That's pretty much the most modern field tank the Russians have. Midway through the T-90 run, they did move over to a different engine, so it's we can't say it's still in the present day. But it had an enormously long run, and it was just an incredible shame he got purged in the late 30s, because to think what he could have done with wartime priority on his projects, it would have been something pretty exciting. Mm-hmm. For reference, the U.S. in World War II didn't field an engine with more than 500 horsepower. And thanks to Chelpan's and the Kharkiv train factory, they had an engine at the start of the war that was 50 horsepower, more powerful.
And they shot him. He was killed?
Yeah.
He was killed. There was an official apology and a rehabilitation later, but yeah, it didn't do
We're
him
sorry.
Any favors.
But so much for the theory that, because there is a theory, which maybe has some truth to it, but obviously very, very qualified some, that, you know, the people who were shot were a lot of old Bolsheviks who were, you know, gumming up the works. And so this allowed a bunch of junior officers, fresh new energy to come up. But obviously it took down a lot of talent too, mostly a lot of talent. I'm talking about Stalin's terror. Mm-hmm. But anyway, yeah. Okay. So moving forward, correct me if I'm wrong, but two of the big workhorse tanks in the war, at least as it started last year, the T-64, which is pretty old, but still a workhorse, and the T-72, more T-64s on the Ukraine side, more T-72s on the Russian side, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, this is another little fascinating twist. Basically, the T-64 program was meant to deliver a high-end Russian tank in the late 50s, 60s. And it was the final tank of a legendary guy, A.A. Morozov, who had been involved way back in the T-34 project, maybe not doing such great work on the first one. The T-34-85, the late war improvement, was very much his. The T-55, the most mass-produced tank in history, the 54-55, that was a Morozov tank. And then as he was approaching retirement, he wanted to make this, it was going to be his last symphony, this amazing tank, bring all the most advanced concepts together. And that created the T-64, which at the time was largely considered a failure. The reason Ukraine's got so many is that they couldn't afford to move them very far away from the factory because they had to go back for repairs.
The T-64 was a Kharkiv product, right?
Yep, coming out of the Kharkiv factory, and the result of its very bad reliability when it was introduced was that they couldn't move it too far away from the factory because it had to keep going back for repairs. And that comes down to it had a very advanced, what they called a posed piston engine, where the pistons meet in the middle of the cylinders, which let it be a multi-fuel engine and very low flat ones to create a low flat tank. It was ahead of its time, especially for training field mechanics in an army. And so that's why the Ukrainians have T-64s. It's mostly matured into a much better tank. But what the Russians, the Soviets did with the failing T-64 program was grab the bits that work, shove it into pretty much a tried and true design from the past, and voila, you've got a T-72. And they're not the only ones this happens to. Something quite similar happens to the British with Challenger not that far away in time, where their projects all fail and they grab the bits that work and make a less advanced tank that actually becomes brilliant. So that's the origin of the T-72, still rumbling away with its T-34 engine in the back.
Right. So the this tank genius is, you know, swan song, final goodbye, was a flop, but ultimately wound up being retooled and either made viable as a T-64 today, or its DNA was taken out and sort of injected in the T-72.
Yeah, the T-64 the Ukrainians are using it seems to be going as a pretty solid tank these days. Mm-hmm. It was just in the 1960s, weren't quite ready for it.
Right.
I remember when I was a very naive tank fancier in a very aesthetic way, the Russian tanks, and I've heard they had a height limit, like you couldn't be over 5'7" or something. And they looked it, you know, they looked really compact, low to the ground, hard to hit, with a giant gun and you know, no room for anything else.
Yeah, something that's little appreciated is we're talking about these Western tanks to be sent to Ukraine. They're all in the high 70s, even going to 80-ton range. Whereas Russian MBTs tend to be in the 40 to 50 ton range. So in some cases, almost half the weight. And when you're trying to put tactical bridging units forward to cross rivers, every extra ton is a lot. So the Russians, they took out the loader and replaced it with the autoloader. We're definitely going to have to talk more about autoloaders. They made their tanks incredibly flat. Yeah, they call it the fry pan turret that's pretty much ubiquitous from the 1950s to today.
Yes.
And a colossal gun, 125-millimeter gun. The biggest tank gun currently in use in the West is 120 millimeters. And what, one thing with tank guns is every time you add a millimeter to that headline number, the whole thing scales. The most extreme example would be in World War II, the American 75-millimeter next to the 76. The 76 is twice the length. 1 millimeter makes that much difference to the overall shell. So the Russians with their 125s for quite a while now, that is a significantly bigger gun than
let's talk about bridging here, because as far as I know, no bridging units are going to Ukraine with these tanks. But this is a well-watered, flat country, lots of rivers. They do supposedly have an amphibious capacity, both, I think, the Abrams and the Leopard 2. How well does it work?
It's not as mature and heavily used as the Soviet waiting capacities. Generally, you think about it, the first blush, waiting your tank with a snorkel underwater with zero visibility of your own and God knows what's at the bottom of the river seems like a quick way to be tired of life. Certainly in Soviet doctrine was that when they had a bridge crossing going over a river, they'd engineer an underwater pathway and run that as a second stream with their wading vehicles so they weren't taking up bridge capacity. That still requires quite a leap of faith as your tank lurches into the brown and you just keep the engine running and hope you come out the other side. I wouldn't want to do it myself. You quite rarely see tanks waiting in combat conditions, and it partly they're running around with a snorkel on a battlefield with shrapnel going everywhere, and the snorkel's just sitting out on the back of the tank. Would you want to trust your life to the structural integrity of that? After a couple of days out there,
we're going to want to get to the Leopard and the Abrams and the Challenger, but let's first finish up with a few of these things here because most of the battle. So the T-72s. There are also some T-90s and even a couple of T-14s. What's the T-90 and the T-14? And I guess the T-80, is that mostly export? I don't know.
There's been a few T-80s on the battlefield in Ukraine. That was another attempt at a high-end tank, and they went with a turbine engine because the Americans had done that with the Abrams, and famously in Grozny, they all ran out of fuel at the same time. there are T-80s around. A lot of ways the systems are similar to the T-72. It's as built, a bit more advanced. The T-90 is in many ways a T-72 with some Western upgrades. Particularly, there was a French targeting system that Russia wasn't supposed to get that somehow turned up in enormous numbers. Questions are still being asked about that one. And that's a problem for the Russians now in that the availability of those upgrade parts for new build T-90s aren't there. As the war goes on, and I mean, we've seen all the pictures of them pulling tanks out of, what's euphemistically called storage, but just looks like pits to most people. So they're pulling a lot of very old tanks like T-62s out there, but the capacity to build more T-90s, if they can convince the Indians to get off their production lines, because India makes up most of the T-90 market in the world, much more so than Russia. So that a lot of interesting negotiations happening there. But T-90 is essentially an upgraded T-72. They're very much the same tank. Big thing to note with the T-72 is while it lacks sophistication and it is built around this ammunition carousel that is quite dangerous, although most other tanks share that weakness in one way or another, the engine is
Can you explain ammunition carousel?
Yes, absolutely. So to make the autoloader work in the Russian the T-64 had something similar but a bit different. You've got a carousel, like a cartridge, like an old Tommy gun, basically, of shells in the bottom of the tank turret, and that rotates around and drives new ammunition into the gun as needed, which takes out the need to have a gunner in the tank, which lets you build the tank much smaller.
Right. They were very proud of getting down to a 3-man crew, right, in the T-64 and T-72.
Yeah, which is a big advance. And the Americans are really starting to look at it now. seriously. It was a long way ahead, and the French also did a lot of stuff with autoloaders around the same time. It does have some disadvantages, but fundamentally, a guy who's just there to put shells in the gun, if you can automate that, then that's probably a good thing.
Right.
Yeah, but you've got this carousel of ammunition at the bottom of the turret, and what's turning out, to the surprise of very few, is the most dangerous thing in the tank, the most likely thing to cause a catastrophic explosion, is its own ammunition. And, mm-hmm. I mean, you look at the number of losses of battleships.
Yes.
You know, it's almost always its own ammunition being cooked off. So this is a problem. And I think in future tank designs, we will see finally a move away from storing ammunition in the turret. At the moment, only the American Abrams fully partitions its ammunition from its crew. Everyone else's tanks have got some ammunition stowage in the crew compartment.
So quick question. So you mean when the ammunition goes off kind of like by its own, or I guess more obviously, it's that they get hit in the turret. So you want to aim for the turret and that sets off the chain reaction, or?
Well, it's when the tank gets hit somewhere, and particularly with all these guided missiles and shoulder-fired anti-tank weapons, they're using shaped charges, which if anyone wants to know about those and doesn't already, the slow-mo guys on YouTube, they're shaped, just to search for slow-mo guys shaped charge, they're doing in hyper slow motion what essentially weapons testers have done for decades, and you can actually see how these shaped charges work, and it's quite an eye-opener. But it's basically creating a pencil-thin jet that penetrates the armor, and that's not actually that dangerous in the tank unless it hits something that explodes. It's obviously a very bad day when this jet bursts into your tank, and if you're in the way, you're going to take a severely bad injury, but not necessarily fatal, and not necessarily fatal for everyone. But if it hits some ammunition stored in the tank, then everyone's dead very quickly.
That would explain why you see so many pictures of blown up tanks where the turret, I mean, I remember seeing this in Skinvali in South Ossetia when I was there. You'd see like all the tank, you know, in one place, and then the turret like 30 yards away or something, you know.
That's it, particularly with this carousel, and this is something that the Javelin and the Enlaw are particularly targeting with the top attack. So it comes in the top, and they know already that there's this huge platen of ammunition laid out, and it, coming in from the top, it becomes almost a certainty that the jet's going to intercept one of those.
Right.
Okay.
All right. And I don't know, is the T-14 worth even mentioning yet?
I don't view the T-14 as a real tank yet. It's really a technology demonstrator and a prototype at this point. If any do get to Ukraine, it'll be very interesting to see how they go. Mm-hmm. But it's not going to change the battlefield that much in the numbers it's available. Although you could make the same argument about British Challengers. So
maybe we should talk about the numbers and what the influence of these imports of Leopard 2s and Abrams will actually do. Like, how many tanks is Ukraine fielding now? How many operational tanks do they have versus how many Russian tanks?
I don't have any numbers I trust on how many are left operational on either
side. It's hard to find that.
I would say at the start of the war, the Ukrainians had around 1,000. Sorry, I'm speaking off the top of my head there. And the Russians had, you know, maybe three times as much. They both destroyed a lot. Certainly when the big breakout around Kharkiv happened, late last year, there were media reports of armored fists of 8 tanks, which suggests 2 exhausted sides where even a relatively small concentration of armor can be quite interesting. And both sides are largely using their armor as what, you know, the purists would call assault guns, not tanks, which is really the same thing, trust me, where it just rumbles forward with the infantry. Something shoots at them, and then they eliminate what's shooting at them, and then they keep rumbling forward. But they're staying in close contact with the infantry, which is, you know, some people would call that good combined arms rather than speaking derisively about assault guns.
Right.
It's more that, I, as an amateur watcher, was tempted to speak derisively about a tank rumbling into town with no infantry screen. And that was when the Javelin seemed to come into its own, although it seems to have been dealt with. Is that right?
I Well, I don't think the Russians are doing too many armored thrusts at the moment that are amenable to that sort of countering. I mean, at the start of the war, if it had worked, we would have called it a brilliant use of Blitzkrieg, but it didn't work, right. So everyone's making fun of it. But when the Russians are charging huge streams of vehicles down highways, you're really amenable. And any fast advance is going to, you're not going to be able to clear every hedgerow. So it's always a gamble you take.
Yeah, I mean, I think implicit in that gamble was, and they're not going to really know how to fight, or they're going to be so shocked and awed that they won't even get their act together in time. And that obviously didn't happen. But anyway, so let's get back to the story. So, can you tell us a bit about the Leopard 2s and maybe the Abrams and the Challengers? And then I think we'll get into some of the way that the tank and armored, well, we'll probably have to talk about other armored vehicles, and then we'll talk about how the war has sort of changed. But first, let's talk about these new Western tanks, which are the new game changers or not, you know? Yeah.
Yeah, look, my read of the sources, and I just want to quickly stress I have no classified access whatsoever, is that they're not talking about these the German or American tanks getting to Ukraine realistically before the end of this year or even next year.
Wow.
Leopards
also?
Yeah. The reason is, of course, none of this is about helping Ukraine. This is about helping KMW and General Dynamics. They're going for new builds. They're not opening up any strategic reserves or transferring any from line units. So they have to wait until they build them. So it's fantastic for the companies. They've got new orders. Ukraine's sitting there without tanks. So don't really get too excited about that. And I could be wrong on those timelines, but that's what journalists are writing about in publications. So let's go with that.
I'd heard that about the Abrams. That the Abrams, I mean, the Washington Post just came out and basically, you know, it's the Langley Post. I mean, they basically came out and leaked to the paper. The Abrams are only there to give cover for the Leopards. Like, you know, the Abrams, man, they aren't going in there. They're just there for show. That is to say, they're not even going to go in for show probably, but they're there so that Schultz can say, hey, the Americans are doing it. That's at least the PR about it. But I didn't realize, well, let's talk about the Leopard 2 because that seems to have been a very sought after, successful export tank. A lot of places have wanted it. So what's so good about it, or is it that good?
Firstly, the Germans are more relaxed about who they sell to than the Americans. The other one is it was built for export. The Abrams, certainly the Abrams that Ukraine's going to get are what they call FMS versions, which is foreign military sales, which, as I'm sure you've heard about export versions before, means not as good.
Those are what the Saudis have in Yemen, but you know,
Particularly the armor scheme isn't as good and doesn't have depleted uranium in it. And realistically, no one's going to send their best, most advanced tank to Ukraine to get destroyed on television and then torn apart by the Russians.
The F-117 in Serbia.
That's right. I know. Not deliberately, anyway. Yeah.
Certainly, it's not a favoured option. The really interesting thing, to digress slightly, is the British sending Challenger 2 at this point. That screams to me that their Challenger 3s are using a totally different armour scheme if they're willing to expose Challenger 2's armour to this scrutiny. But the theory that I've heard and that I like but is just a theory and has nothing to back it up whatsoever is that the main thing the Germans were hanging on for is they do not want a whole heap of Leopards going to Ukraine and being on the nightly news blown up. And,
yes, that's what I was going to say. It's bad for export marketing, right?
Yeah.
You don't want them in a place where they can get blown up. You want them just to, you know, where people have, I don't know, small arms or something, and that's it.
Yeah, that's the idea. That's always the dream, Mark. Yeah. Knight on horseback fighting peasants. But so that's why they wanted the Americans to also be putting M1s into Ukraine so that they were exposed to the same risk and they could say, hey, you know, both sides versus just blown up Leopards and then they all go off on their the next generation of tank sales. So Leopard 2 has been incredibly successful, partly because it's very modular and the customers are able to choose what they want. partly because the Germans have set up translations of all the manuals. It was built from the ground up for that sort of export sales, whereas, you know what it's like for Americans or any Anglophone, really. We just shout louder at people and figure they'll understand us.
Learn English!
I found myself doing that in the taxi. I don't want to talk about it.
Sure. There's just a mindset in American military exports that everyone will learn English versus having to translate the materials. And that's no small thing when you're sending, you know, hundreds of tanks to be driven by 19-year-olds who couldn't get out of national service.
Right.
That's part of the success of Leopard, partly the availability. But lots and lots of countries have chosen it. Now, is the armor as good as Abrams? Some would suggest maybe not as good. It certainly seems to be good enough for most uses. Definitely many have been destroyed, but that's the nature of sending tanks into harm's way.
Right. How much do these little gradations – I mean, I know we all at least at one time did this, like, you know, the guys from Stripes at the end, like, you know, we test the new Russian tanks. Does it matter much whether you're in a T-72? Because I know Schwarzkopf is supposed to have said, if we'd switch tank fleets – we'd still have won.
Right, that our tanks would still have won because our tank crews were better trained, and so it's not the tank so much as the tank crew.
Yeah, I think superiority helped there too. But it's really hard to say. What you can say from battle testing is the Challenger tanks are very heavily armored and more so than probably anyone else, but they also are heavier than everyone else. So again, how the Ukrainians are going to go getting those across bridges, particularly all of their engineering teams are going to be built around Russian T-series tanks, which are, you know, 30, 40 tons lighter. That's a lot of difference. Every ton is exponential when you're dealing with road wear and damage to machinery and just difficulty of maintenance. So that's going to be a big problem for them. We've also got to really touch on this incredible grab bag of vehicles Ukraine's trying to operate now. That is not something anyone would choose. And I'm certainly Australia sending its Bushmasters and things like that. I mean, what are you going to do with 12 Bushmasters? They seem to like them. But in terms of keeping parts and supplies and training and manuals in Ukrainian, that's going to be hugely problematic. And if you're a quartermaster being told, oh, send one of your vehicles to the war zone, it's not going to be the best one. It's going to be the one that's been at the back of the shop for a while. So there's
hangar queens. The
hangar queens are getting disposed of at the moment. Yeah. And if it's only going to last 6 weeks, I guess that's fine. That's kind of, you know, getting back to development and production philosophies in World War II as well. The Challenger is the heavyweight champion. I mean, there was a case in Iraq where one got lost a track and was hit by 72 RPGs by insurgents. And when they finally recovered it and opened the hatches, the crew was still inside and fine.
A bit deaf, you know.
it would have been a really long day in the office for that crew waiting to hear what was being brought up next. Dare I say, you've got to think that the fact that the British still send children and families that matter to war in tanks might have something to do with why they have the best protected tank in the business.
It really is extraordinary that the number of British tank officers with hyphenated last names is extraordinary. And often one of the hyphenated last names sounds Norman French.
It's, you know, 1,000 years later, the Norman French still hold the economic high ground in Britain.
Yeah.
That's funny. But so among those tanks, it is the heavyweight. It could take a lot of shots, and if it hits you. But so why was it called obsolete? I mean, to me, I kind of think like, okay, so the Challengers is among heavyweight boxers, it's sort of like the Butterbean of tanks, or I don't know if you guys know Butterbean. He was sort of my Okay. Why was it called obsolete and, you know, mothballed or slated to be mothballed like 4 or 5 years ago?
Well, they've decided to – they want to build Challenger 3, and that does mean the fleet's going out. I'm just pure guesswork here. The fact they're willing to send Challenger 2 to Ukraine says to me that they've gone in a very different direction with the next generation of armor.
Right.
And so they don't mind if this one gets destroyed. or figured out.
Yeah, and these are budgeting decisions. It often comes down to you got to make room for the new inventory. Like, nobody ever argued the A10 doesn't work, but it's getting in the way of the budgeting. Therefore, you know, anybody who says the A10 works, let's keep it, is, according to one Air Force general, a traitor. That happens all the time.
Yeah, but at some extent, you've got to keep the BAE tank production line employing people who know what they're doing, and the tank design bureaus need to stay in work. So if you want to maintain this capability, there does come a point where you just have to build a new generation.
Right.
But we have had huge advances in material sciences in the last 50 years, like never before seen by humanity, and some of that's going into tank armor. You know, they've got all these layers of different composite materials,
right,
and the way that affects the enemy's incoming penetrators is quite the complex area.
Around the millennium, you heard a lot of talk about the era of tanks is over. And then maybe a bit later, or roughly simultaneously, Chobham armor came in, and that was a British innovation. And then reactive armor. Mm-hmm. How much difference have those innovations made?
Look, Chobham, the new generation of it's known as Dorchester, but it's a shorthand for Western composite armor. Chobham definitely was a huge game changer. Up until they figured it out, tanks were moving away from being armored altogether. The Leopard 1 series was pretty much only proof against small arms and 12.7 millimeter, 50 cal rounds, that sort of thing, and was not designed to stop anything bigger than that. With the idea being that, well, if we can make it faster and carry a bigger gun, then that's better. And then the Russians actually pioneered composite armor. They don't get a lot of credit for that either.
Interesting.
But, the Russians,
that's kind of a theme here.
I know.
Yeah.
Huh?
The Russians. Well, also, you know, that. Folks will say that concepts are relatively cheap to implement, and so that was an area where the Russians tried to get ahead. But they also ended up with much more varied tank fleets, which, as we've said, carries some costs as well. So the Russians were the first with composite armor in the field, and but the British definitely went a different direction. And there's something about their form of laminate that has to be straight lines, which is why American and British tanks are so angular and flat. Flat on those angles, but just because of the nature of the, I think they're calling it, well, Challenger 2 had Dorchester armor, but yeah, Chobham.
Do you know what the elements are, the composites? I just, as a chemistry nerd, I'm just kind of curious. Like, what they, you know.
Highly confidential, Mark, but people who have seen them when they've been burst open have described it as bags of powder in plastic bags.
Wow. Interesting.
And we're talking metals, we're talking heavy metals, you know, famously depleted uranium, which turns the whole, if a tank gets hit, turns it into a hazardous chemical site.
Right. But it absorbs the shock better, basically,
Its atomic weight means it's harder to move aside, so a layer of that in there when you're trying to disrupt whatever's trying to get into your tank. It definitely seems to work, and has created old model RPGs definitely do struggle to get through this stuff. You know, this is why they've moved to top attacks and tandem warheads and bigger charges and the whole arms race.
Right.
But it definitely was a huge game changer. There was just this generation of steel hard tanks that around, you know, Yom Kippur War in 1973, everyone looked at it and said, these essentially may as well not be armored at all. And they came up with this laminate armor, and they said, oh, we can go with super heavyweight tanks that we never would have dreamed of loading our logistical system with, because they've actually got some degree of protection. And I'd say as big a change has been the Israeli Trophy active protection system, which appears to work very well. And that's a real bone of contention as to whether that's going to go on these Western tanks going to Ukraine, because it's Israeli, and I don't think they give them permission for it. And my reading between the lines, no one's saying Trophy, which means they might be getting stuck with some crappy Lockheed knockoff. But the fact that the U.S. Army is still buying Trophy says to me that it's much better than anything America's been able to come up with yet.
Yeah, this is a strange tank technology. I want to ask you about it. Well, we've got you here. Reactive armor, it's sort of like, you know, installing a defensive claymore mine so that as the projectile is hitting, the armor is blasting outward.
Yes. So slightly different beasts. So explosive reactive armor, and that's the stuff that looks like Lego blocks on the outside of tanks. The idea is that when a round is incoming, it hits the explosive reactive armor, which goes kaboom, and that disrupts the incoming round because they're all reliant on very exotic physics to get through these huge amounts of armor, and that's all quite relatively delicate. So that's explosive reactive armor and it can disrupt both kinetic penetrators, which are the big lawn darts that big tank guns fire, and the chemical warheads that shoulder fired anti-tank missiles use. So that's the idea. Obviously, it doesn't work all the time. It definitely works some of the time. We've definitely seen tanks in Ukraine take hits and keep operating, but also we've seen them blow their turrets up. Then you've got active protection systems, which is basically a series of it's almost like an Aegis system on ships, where it's got radars pointing in all directions, and when it detects an incoming anti-tank missile, it fires a shotgun shell at the incoming round. Israel's had it's made Merkavas much scarier, where they're using those in the Middle East, and the rest of the world's very impressed with them. It does weigh 5 tons, so it's another 5 tons on top of your already porky Western tanks. But I've not seen anyone confirm yet that any of these vehicles going to Ukraine is going to have Trophy. If they're having active protection, it's going to be a not as good system.
Right. We should say again real quickly here that talk about the geography of Eastern Ukraine. I mean, it is a lot of that whole region. It's pretty wet in spring, even summer, depending on the rains, and definitely in the fall. And so a lot of streams, a lot of bogs or marshes, a lot of rivers, right? So, I mean, and so a lot of bridges. Yeah. And so you would think that the Soviet Russian tanks, the 40-ton ones, are going to be a lot more kind of useful than these 60-plus-ton Western tanks that are coming in. I don't know. What do you think?
You would definitely think that. It's going to be a huge problem. It creates simpler problems for the Russians. You know, when they're looking at a map, they've got obviously the tear weights of all the bridges in Ukraine. They would have sent some guys out before the invasion to take some pictures of that.
Presumably.
it's a pretty easy thing to do. Just a backpacking family could pick that up. and once literally computers are already set up so that truck drivers can plot safe routes for whatever weight truck they're driving. So this is all open source civilian tech to be able to plot where the Ukrainian tanks could possibly come from. That's not to say they couldn't build some pontoon bridges or some other temporary bridging, but it absorbs a lot more of that stuff than the lighter tanks do, and everyone's got limits in their logistic capacities. So it creates some problems for the Russians. It does also, but some things are easier to solve in that they can only be coming through over this bridge because it's a strong enough bridge to take that column.
Right.
Not the other small bridges in the area. They have to take the one heavy bridge.
That's it. That's a nervous place to be crossing that bridge because it would be a good time to hit it with a missile bombardment.
Yeah.
I would say a classic example of this, late World War II on the Western Front, the Pershing tanks finally get sent into the war zone because Leslie McNair was dead. And they got sent forward and then they'd hit a waterway and the Shermans would go across on the available tactical bridging and the Pershings would sit there sadly watching the Shermans go ahead. It happened numerous times. This isn't just a hypothetical thing. We can point to this.
Right. The one takeaway about the Leopard 2, Abrams, and Challengers, although they're all good tanks, is that just don't expect them on the battlefield game-changing anything anytime soon. It's more of a psychological boost.
Your challenges you might, and my suspicion, because the UK has been running this enormous training program for Ukrainian soldiers, is that when the British announced the challenges were going, that the training was already completed. They could set up very quickly. But like we said, they're a very, really heavy tank. Ukraine's going to have some issues. They're going to have to keep them together just to keep the parts going in their direction. They've got an orphan ammunition type that no one else uses, which is they've got a rifled gun which spins the round as it goes out. Does make for – they use an ammo type called high explosive squash head or HESH, which it sort of pancakes onto the outside of what it hits and then explodes and creates, you know, those executive toys, Newton's cradles, where you drop a ball and the ball on the other side fires out. That principle, so whatever it hits, it can hit enormous thicknesses of concrete and spall a huge blister out the other side, and similarly tank armor. And that's one of the things explosive reactive armors was first designed, was to counter this sort of ammunition. As a very solid, hard-to-kill vehicle that can take out enemy bunkers, you could spearhead a really interesting breakout with these sometime, and the British would absolutely love it if someone did, because... yeah, they're looking at the next generation of export SARs too.
Right. So I guess now let's talk a little bit about how tanks are being used on the battlefield. I mean, it's largely been a pretty static war. I mean, especially when the ball is more in kind of Russia's court, it's very slow, gruesome grind. And with Ukraine, well, I mean, their southern offensive in Kherson didn't really go anywhere, but it did its job. I mean, first of all, it opened up the whole Kharkiv area so they could just go and walk right through that. And then it depleted enough Russian force in the Kherson area that Russia basically had to withdraw from half of the oblast. But aside from that, it's been a fairly static war. I mean, this Bakhmut battle, which is very World War I-y, you know, it's just it barely moves. So how are the tanks used, and are they used together with other armored vehicles of any kind, or like what have you noticed? I mean, there aren't too many tank on tank battles, like, you know, the Battle of Kursk. It's not like that, right?
Look, we all dream of Kursk and Fulda Gas, right. But you know, we have to make do with one-on-one little tank engagements.
Yes.
There have been, and I was just relying on the videos that come out, and someone's had to take that video and say, let's let the world see it. So it's serving someone's agenda.
Right.
So I get a lot of people sending me stuff all the time, as you can imagine, as I'm sure they do with you guys too. A lot of it I take with a grain of salt. I mean, I look at it. I'm interested, but I'm wary of drawing too many conclusions at this stage. I would say, in general, tanks are being used mostly as assault guns, partly because if they go charging forward on their own, you know, both sides are bristling with anti-tank weapons, and they're going to be taking shots to the side and rear that they can't survive. So they have to move forward with the infantry, and that brings you back down to, you know, walking pace for most part. I would note the lesser mentioned thing in this recent round of sales to Ukraine of equipment is the infantry fighting vehicles are probably as important as the tanks, because that at least gets your lets your infantry move up. And sure, IFE, if it gets hit by an artillery round, that's game over with a direct hit, but it will keep shrapnel out and keep the troops alive in these highly hostile environments, at least if they can get a bit closer to the enemy.
One thing I noticed in late 20th century wars by, say, second level powers is that tanks would move in, and infantry fighting vehicles, whether they were BMPs or whatever, even M113s, but they would move into prepared earth positions, and then they were pretty much invulnerable, and you had an armored turret that could fire in any direction, and it would be awfully hard to hit.
Yeah, I mean, someone needs to prepare that position for you under fire. So it's nice work if you can get it. And also the new generation of top attack munitions are making that dug-in, hull-down position maybe slightly less important than it used to be.
Yeah, but the new generation of tanks.
The new generation of tanks, you might notice if you start looking at pictures of them, the turret almost completely covers the whole body of the tank. And this is largely so they can get away with just having one layer of armor over the top of the tank rather than having to do them both. So turrets are getting better protected and sloped, and it's always an arms race. At the moment the top attacks do seem to have some advantage.
But the infantry fighting vehicle, I mean, we're sending the Bradley, and the Germans are sending the Marder.
And the Stryker.
But the Bradley at least has the TOW. I always pronounce that wrong. Is it TOW or TOW?
Yeah. Either works for me. Yep.
All right. Which has supposedly, 2.5-kilometer range, and it's basically a tank destroyer missile. So as a defensive weapon against tanks, it would depend on who fires first, I suppose. Although the TOW, I suppose, is significantly slower than a tank round.
Yeah, you talk to tank guys, and they'll get much more excited these days about thermal images, which let them see the enemy first, than they are necessarily about the size of the tank gun. Similarly, Bradley, with its thermal images, is going to see tanks a long way away. And look at the Gulf War. Bradley's killed an enormous amount of Iraqi armor. It's formidable, but it's at the same time, it's a higher vehicle. If it takes a hit, it's going down. So it's not trying to use a Bradley as a main fighting vehicle is missing its main point, which is the ability to get your infantry in contact with your own tanks forward in an assault.
Right.
And it can deal with a couple of shots if it comes across something nasty.
Right. So what are the supply issues we're talking about here with all these various, infantry fighting vehicles, some APCs, different countries' tanks, and gasoline and repairs, because tanks need constant repairs, don't they?
Absolutely constant. And I'm sure, if you're driving around northern Syria, I mean, we interviewed a guy once who'd driven a stolen T-55 around northern Syria. But even then, it had to go home at night, and the mechanic had to do about 4 hours of work a day on it. That was interesting as well, because they were making the ammunition for it in sheds in Rahava. But
wow.
Yeah. Which wasn't something anyone sort of thought they could do.
Right.
Yeah. So, yes, tanks need a lot of maintenance. Just even things like tensioning the tracks involves all the crew rolling around in the mud and leaning on pry bars. A lot of work. That stuff, the crew is supposed to be able to do a level of field maintenance, but the parts are just some – either Ukraine have mastered something really new and clever with their little Android tablets, and they're using that to dispatch logistics in a way that humans could never have done before.
Interesting.
Which is possible, because they're definitely using
Amazon drone delivery kind of thing.
Yeah, maybe that style of thing. Or they're just throwing stuff at the front line and running it till it gets destroyed, which certainly involves a lot less effort, but does run you through equipment faster. I would say that part of the small shipment of tanks they're talking about right now is just seeing what the Ukrainians do with them, whether they can support them.
Right. Well, I got to say, people in that part of the world, because they the cars were not easy in trucks and stuff for many years until like the last 20, 30 years, they're really good with making do, like clothespins in the Lada, on the engine block, like all kinds of wire hangers and getting things working. They had to learn that. I don't know, maybe that skill has gone a bit in the last 20 years with all the higher quality sort of Western goods. But definitely when they first moved out there, it was just amazing how resourceful people were dealing with what they had,
And as long as you're dealing with big old diesel engines, you're probably going to be okay with that level of, what we'd call it bush mechanics. But you've also then got the problem with Abrams that it runs on a turbine. Which is
Can you explain what that is and why it's so difficult, in terms of supplies and whatever?
It's basically something very similar to a jet engine, sits inside the tank, and it has a lot of advantages. For a start, it can really run on any fuel. You can literally run it on Chanel number 5 if you've got money to fill it up. But it's a jet engine, and that requires mechanics who are trained for jet engines, not for servicing tractors. Whereas anyone on a Ukrainian farm who's got a tractor going can get a diesel engine tank going, probably with some margin of error.
Right.
What about the mileage on the Abrams? That's one of the criticisms that a lot of people have had, like 3 gallons to the mile. Is that accurate?
Well, look, none of these tanks have great fuel economy, and you double the weight, you're more than doubling the fuel needed to get the tank over a given distance. So that's a big deal for all of them. Definitely, the original model Abrams didn't have what they call an auxiliary power unit. So if you wanted to keep your thermal sight running and your tank, seeking targets on the horizon, you had to have the main engine running.
Oh my God.
They are going to send M1A2s, pretty sure that'll have the auxiliary power unit, which is basically a small petrol, it might be a diesel engine, that runs as a generator inside the tank when you're not using the main thing. And they're doing a lot with lithium batteries these days as well on some of the newer tanks to not have to run the engine. But yeah, turbines are thirsty, and it's fine when you've got the US logistics system laying jet fuel pipelines down as fast as you can advance, which they did in Iraq. But Ukraine is not going to have that kind of capability. Mm-hmm. So it's going to have to be used carefully.
That raises a really sensitive question. Like, are they going to end up having to use US personnel, or for that matter, German mm-hmm. personnel, British personnel, even if it's not officially the case?
There was someone on Twitter the other day making the point where they were talking about transferring helicopters, that it would literally be easier to teach the existing crews to speak Ukrainian than it would take someone who wasn't trained up for helicopter warfare and train them up. So
yeah,
we're definitely reaching the point where the advisors and the trainers are going to start doing what they always do, which is just saying, give me that gun, I'll show you how it's done.
Right. Come on, it's such a great shot. I'll go back to advising right afterwards.
Yeah. Right. And as they're shooting the gun, they'll say, I want to announce here that I'm not being involved in this war. I'm merely showing how to use the gun, you know. But because I've been denied, yeah. It's the old slippery slope thing. So what about the use of drones? I mean, we had a guest on, Samuel Bendit, in the last year, about drones, drone warfare. I mean, it's pretty amazing, and just how many drones are being used. And I mean, I would almost, when you told me about, you know, when you were talking about like thermal imaging, for example, and the technological advantages that some of these Western tanks would have, but wouldn't they be to some degree canceled out by cheap drones?
If you don't counter the cheap drones, absolutely.
Right.
I think there are a few different approaches you can take to drones. One is that if it's a full drone, it's got a transmission signal, as opposed to if it's completely autonomous, that moves into a different territory. But if it's someone with a little controller controlling a drone in their own line of sight, it's emitting radio signals all the time. You've got the right equipment, it's a big glowing light. you start firing proximity fused 30-millimeter anti-air cannons in their direction. They're fragile things. Anything that flies has to be fragile. So there are things in what we call a peer conflict, a high-intensity conflict, that can be done to counter them to some extent, but they definitely do change the game. There's no question about that. One of the things I loved was seeing that a lot of Russian tankers were using drones not to go out and find the enemy or drop grenades on them. They were just planting them in the sky above their own tank so they could see what was shooting at them.
That leads to another question that we wanted to ask you. There's been a lot of talk recently about software called Kropiva in Ukrainian, which I gather means nettle, which will allow, I mean, tank guns were not originally designed to be optimal artillery, something about the angles and I don't know.
But, and the muzzle velocities, yeah.
Right, okay. But now, supposedly, you can use them in... You can use this software in combination with surveillance drones, not even armed drones, to allow a tank to kill an enemy tank at a range up to 10 kilometers. Have you heard about this?
Yeah, I heard about that. They're claiming the world's longest tank-on-tank kill, which is very much annoying people in the West who care about their own records. But it's... seems legit to a point. One thing to note is that tank main guns are designed to be incredibly high velocity for two reasons, one of which is that if it's moving at 2 kilometers a second and it's going to drop a meter in the first second, then that makes it quite easy to just point your gun at the target and hit fire. So that's the first reason you want them very high velocity. Just if it travels very flat and fast, it's easier to hit the target. Mm-hmm. The other reason, though, is that if you're trying to penetrate the enemy tank, you need as much energy as you can possibly get into what you're firing. So that makes the tank guns unsuited to be artillery for a couple of reasons. Tanks throughout history have often been fitted for indirect fire, though. It's not completely uncommon or unheard of. But what the Ukrainians are doing with their this nettle system, certainly what they're saying they're doing, everything with a grain of salt, is that they've basically got some Android tablets with software loaded on to act as artillery fire computers for them. And then they're able to, communications coordination, warp their fire. So, you fire and you miss, but you can see what you miss by and you move it back a bit and up a bit and you did try again and see where you're at, which is a time-honoured way of getting artillery onto target. As long as there's been artillery, people have been doing that. It's better if you can fully calculate before you fire and hit first go, but that's not normally a capability most folks have got. So the nettle system appears to be letting them use tanks as artillery, which isn't the worst thing in the world because they are protected. It's also not what they're ideally for. But if your tank's sitting there on the front line not doing anything else and you've got spare ammunition, then why not get it doing some fire missions?
Where have you seen the tanks being most effective and where not? I mean, I've seen various videos of some of these open field maneuvers, and they all, at least the ones I've seen, they generally look pretty disastrous. But they seem really useful in more close-up stuff. I don't know. Sometimes.
Yeah, tank commanders don't like getting close to anything.
I know.
But they don't have a lot of choices either. Yeah. Definitely some of the stuff you've seen in the media of these Ukrainian Zerg rushes, if they don't work, then you start saying they're human wave tactics and that the commander is a butcher. When they do work, everyone's a genius, which is part of the nature of the game. The tanks essentially give their crew a better chance of crossing that open space and closing with the enemy and finding the enemy and then eliminating them. It doesn't give you a perfect chance. It gives you a better chance. And for all that, there's a reason why people literally have nightmares about being cooked alive in tanks brewing up. The casualty rates in tank corps are generally significantly less than infantry. It's still a better deal than having your unprotected skin slogging across open ground.
Right. I guess you just feel wrongly. It's sort of like flying versus riding a motorcycle. You feel wrongly, like you're not fully in control. Whereas if you're on the ground, you're like, I am the protagonist of a sci-fi novel. I won't be taken down, that's it. Can we talk briefly about anti-tank weaponry and what has been useful? I mean, the Javelin was the hero of the first sort of month and a half of the war, though you don't hear much about it anymore.
You look at the numbers shipped to Ukraine and you look at the number of tanks even the Ukrainians are claiming destroyed. And let's remember, for every tank any army in history has claimed destroyed, there's one tank that was parked on a hill that everyone's taken a shot at going past. And that's claimed as 50 kills, right?
Right.
That's not a criticism of Ukraine. That's everyone.
No, that's war.
Even taking the Ukrainian numbers of claimed Russian kills, it's taken a lot of anti-tank weapons for every tank they've destroyed. Partly that's the distribution problem, that if you spread your anti-tank weapons across every soldier in the line, then you don't have them anywhere near where the enemy thrust is coming. Well, you don't have all of them there. It's not that different situation to when the Panzerfaust came out in World War II or when the Russian anti-tank missiles came out in Soyuz in 1973 in Yom Kippur. There have always been moments when tanks are very vulnerable to these things. Generally, countermeasures come into place, tactics change. If it stops you using your tank as offensively as you like, then that anti-tank weapon's having a very real effect. But it's also worth noting, tanks aren't that expensive in the world of military procurement. You're talking $5 to $10 million per tank, depending on what you're getting.
Not by Air Force standards.
So let's go with $5 million as a throwaway number. It costs well over $1 million a year to keep a Western soldier in the field. If putting them in a $5 million tank means they're one-tenth as likely to die early, then that investment really starts to look like it's paying off. So you need to consider all of the costs, I guess. But anti-tank weapons are definitely creating headaches and problems. That's no doubt about that. And the technology of top attack is definitely driving big changes in the next generation of tank design. As I think I hinted at earlier, we're probably not going to see ammunition stored in the crew compartment happen anymore.
Right, right.
I think there have been early low-tech precedents for this. This is my suave segue back to Tunisia. Because I was reading up on the Battle of the Kasserine Pass, in which eventually Rommel, up against a really lame American general, led the American tanks and half-tracks and other vehicles into a trap where I think 88 millimeter guns, which were a very effective, unguided German weapon, just killed an enormous number of them.
The Germans had a tactic they called sword and shield, where they would present a bit of a strong front and then withdraw. And time and time and time again, the British and then the Americans would chase after them into the concealed ambush of the 88s. Partly that was because British armor doctrine pretty much demanded that if the enemy is withdrawing, you must follow. So, you know, it was a firing squad offense for officers who didn't do that pretty blindly. Because what do you do? You come back and say, oh, the enemy ran away, so we didn't chase them. And you don't know that you can't prove the ambush was there if you don't wander into it.
You're letting down your hyphenated name.
When the British had pretty much figured that out by the time Kasserine happened, probably didn't approach it in a very good way, tried to warn the Americans about this, and you can imagine some supercilious British officers trying to tell you how to do your job. You might not take it in the spirit it was intended. So the Americans also fell for it in pretty much exactly the same way. It should also be noted, though, that huge amounts of American artillery finally stabilized the situation at Kasserine. So big guns are a problem for tanks. And as a Mad King tank enthusiast, I'm not going to lie about that.
It's just astonishing to me that an unguided artillery piece can kill a moving tank. But I think they had some amazing rate, like they killed a tank for every 20 rounds fired or something.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, the 88 was intended as a divisional anti-aircraft piece, which, again, weirdly turned out was good for tanks because it had a really high muzzle velocity. So at least that simplified the aiming, that you pretty much put the crosshairs on what you were trying to shoot instead of otherwise if you're leading a moving target. But World War II tanks, remember, they did have to stop to fire. If they wanted to fire with any sort of accuracy. Right. It was a bit of a more stop-start affair, and if they've stopped to fire, then you can shoot at them and things like that.
Yes.
You got to be a damn good gunner to catch something like that as a tank. I mean, their sighting must have been pretty amazing.
Well, the survivors had a bit of practice, and those who were bad at it.
Exactly. Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah. We've had a great overview here of tanks. I mean, tanks have all been in the news. Although it's funny, I don't know if you noticed this, John, like as soon as there was all of this chat, it went on for about 2 months, you've got to get them the Leopards and Germany's selling them, blah, blah, blah. And as soon as the Abrams and the Leopards were announced that they were going there, literally within a day or two, it was, yeah, that's fine, but what they really need are F-16s. I mean, that was almost immediately.
And there was the, don't get your hopes up. Okay, these are going to be nice, but it won't happen overnight, but it will happen, as Rachel Hunter used to say.
I mean, they're good for morale. For the Ukrainian morale, it's good to know that they're willing to cross these red lines, so-called red lines, and back up Ukraine, even if they're not going to be the game changer. I guess that's their primary use. Mm-hmm. And also it draws these countries in deeper into Ukraine's side.
Well, while we've got time, we should let John Griffiths boost his show, because this has been a great advertisement for the show. And you need to tell people how to get it.
Absolutely. So thanks so much for having me on the show. The Totally Tanked podcast, if you search for us, Totally Tanked, and ignore anything about aquariums, the aquarium supply stores and us fight for search engine optimization, you will find us. We're available on pretty much all the podcast apps. We do also do a YouTube live stream that people are welcome to correct us all our terrible mistakes as we go. Just search for Totally Tanked. You will almost certainly find us. And we certainly, it's funny, you know, everyone keeps telling us how the tank's obsolete. It's like, yeah, maybe. And one day it will be. But, you know, this war, it's something that's all about tanks. It's like, oh, these experts were telling me they were completely obsolete.
Yep.
I mean, I guess it depends on the war.
Yeah, I've heard that for most of my life.
It depends on the war, and that war, which is post-tanks, has not yet come, you know.
Yeah, so, this is also weirdly, I mean, obviously Ukraine is a great tank country, famously great tank country. But also it's a war at just the right threat level that kind of suits tanks versus other things. If it was a higher intensity war, maybe not. You know, if there was a lot of air power being used on both sides, it'd be more of an air war. But as it's currently stands, it's a bit of a tank war. So here we go. And I've got to say, the number of downloads of our Leopard 2 and T-72 episodes of people are definitely searching for information at the moment.
Yes. They have full episodes on all the various tanks, not only just the tanks that are being used or being slated to be used in the Ukraine war, so you can know more about them, but also historical tanks. I don't know, you guys just did an episode, I think, on a Japanese tank. I mean, you guys
have
really
gone through.
Right,
the North Asian tanks and the Japanese and Korean ones, they're doing some really interesting innovating. The fact that Poland's just ordered a whole bunch of Korean tanks should tell you that there's some really good stuff coming out of that part of the world, as you'd expect, given they're very good at heavy manufacturing.
Yes. Yeah, interesting. All right, well, John Griffiths, thank you so much for joining us on Radio
Thanks
Warner.
Thanks very much.
Really appreciate
great.
It.
Thanks, guys. It's been great.
Okay, thanks again to John Griffiths of the Totally Tanked podcast. And I think it's great to end a month with pure hardware.
Yeah.
I mean, there's nothing more hardware-y than tanks, right? For the old, for the young
Metal
war
meat.
Nerdling. Yes, exactly. Okay, well, thanks again, everyone, for another great month. And Brendan, John, you're going to be leaving Carthage and Tunisia pretty soon, right, John? And you're going to...
Sadly, yes. We're going first to London, and we have a War Nerd meetup in London around the 7th of February, and I'll advertise it on Facebook.
At the Old White Bear, otherwise known as the Old White Bean, but it's the Old White Bear pub, right, in London. Yes, and we'll post information on that again, too. Yeah.
And then we go to Scotland, where we might also have another Radio War Nerd meetup.
Oh, cool.
Somewhere near Glasgow.
Right. Good. How long are you going to be there for, do you know?
At least a month.
Okay. All right. Thanks again, everyone.
Thanks, everybody.
Bye.